Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, right now, as a matter of fact, Charlotte's one remaining homegrown department store, Belk, writes a new chapter in its history, Chapter 11, Bankruptcy. From humble beginnings in Monroe 133 years ago, Belk grew to be one of the largest retail chains in the South. But in recent years, it has been facing severe headwinds as the nature of retail is changing, shifting from malls to online. That, the pandemic, and the debt incurred when new owners bought Belk from the family that long controlled it has pushed the store to join other major retailers who have also found themselves in dire financial straits in recent years. What will Belk look like as a store and a company following today's declaration of bankruptcy? What is the future for bricks and mortar retail? Well, we spend the hour peeling back the curtain on that with a couple of industry observers. Katrin Helens, her research focuses on the shifting dynamics in digital and bricks and mortar retailing in her role as professor of marketing at the UNC Kenan Flagler School of Business. She joins us this morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us. And Daphne Howland is a senior reporter for Retail Dive, which through newsletters and its website provides insight into trends shaping retail. Thank you for being here as well. Good morning.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
So Belk actually declared, or Sycamore Partners actually declared Belk to be in bankruptcy. They filed for bankruptcy late last night. They're holding the bankruptcy court hearing right now, even as we speak, in Texas. So let me begin with a basic question, Daphne, about bankruptcy. Most of us, ordinary mortals, think of bankruptcy as something that is ruinous, that would put me personally out of business for a good long time. And we would think that if a company goes bankrupt, they're out of business. But that is not the case with Chapter 11. Belk will go on after this day is over. So explain to me what Chapter 11 bankruptcy actually is.
So Chapter 11 bankruptcy is an opportunity to restructure mostly debt and other financial obligations with the goal of saving the business, allowing it to continue as a going concern. What that means is a distressed retailer, in the case of Belk, loaded up with debt, struggling to pay its bills. A bankruptcy judge is really on the side of keeping that business going. That means, landlords, vendors, other people who might be owed money by the business are going to be at a disadvantage because that judge wants to keep Belk going.
Here's a very simple question. Why?
Well, part of it is just, you'd rather have a business continue. A business has, employees. It is within communities. It can be very important. Department stores and Belk in particular, as it was for so long, it was a family-owned business. It's important to its communities wherever its stores are run. So there's a lot of motivation just to not let a business fail. Of course, if you're a landlord or a vendor, you're right, looking at maybe getting a lot of things unpaid.
Well, we'll talk about the losers here in a little while here. William Langley is Belk's chief financial officer. And in the filing that they filed with the court last night, they say that the COVID-19 pandemic directly resulted in drastic declines in sales, revenue, and liquidity. That sounds like they're trying to pin the whole reason for this on the pandemic, as opposed to what's been happening in retail in general, and the fact that Sycamore Partners bought Belk from the Belk family about, it was 2015, so it was 6 years ago, for $3 billion. And they incurred a substantial amount of debt when they did that. How much is the debt playing into this? In other words, had the Belk family maintained control of Belk department stores, would we be talking about bankruptcy this morning?
With the caveat that I cannot know what is in anyone's minds or hearts, I think it's pretty safe to say that the Belk family would have been stewards of the Belk chain in a much different way than Sycamore Partners. When a private equity firm buys a business, the goal is usually within about 5 or so years to set it up as a public company, do an IPO, or sell it to an interested entity. Hmm. It's about that time, 5 or 6 years ago, they bought the company. It's time for them to unload it. This is not the time to be selling a retailer. So, you know, it's just a breaking point sort of time. They can't sell it. They can't IPO it. They have to do something about all that debt that they piled on to Belk. So getting into a Chapter 11 court means they can unload some of that debt, get out of some of their obligations, and maybe restart the clock to some extent.
Catherine, take us back to 2015. You know, it was no secret, I don't think, in 2015 that the picture in retail was not exactly rosy anymore. It certainly accelerated because of the pandemic. It certainly accelerated because of the steady shift to online shopping and the influence of Amazon and your ability to buy anything you want, anytime you want, on your computer. But we had witnessed JCPenney and Sears and other major retailers by that time experiencing exactly what's happening to Belk today. If you are a professional hedge fund like Sycamore Partners, what would make you think that it would be a good investment to buy a retail chain?
Well, one thing I really want to point out, sorry, what you actually said, the word acceleration is spot on. I mean, you cannot blame COVID for anything that is happening at this point in time in retail. Yes, it accelerated so many things, but it's absolutely not the cause. And yes, online retailing does play a major role in that. And what you then have to do is, what you have to sort of like think about is like, what is actually the role of brick and mortar now and in the future? So going back to, is it a good investment? Yes and no, in the sense that there is really a role for bricks in retailing, but you really have to sort of know how to sort of think about it, how to be strategic about it. And probably you also have to be very willing to invest in it, because the way it exists right now is not the way you're going to sort of survive, not now and not in the future. Right. So it is a risky investment, let me put it like that, but you really have to know what to do with it. So going back to Macy's and JCPenney, especially JCPenney, there are also a couple of very classic mistakes that come into play. And that is that at one point in time, they completely lost track of who their consumers are. Is they wanted to go for a completely different type of consumer at that point in time, millennials, now it would be Generation Z, and completely forgetting the core of what their consumers are, which are typically middle-income moms. And once again, it's a very classic mistake, but one that is easily made. So yeah, but I'm assuming that we're going to dig into a lot of these aspects more deeply, but yeah, you cannot sort of like say it's one COVID, and two, it requires a lot of
investment. Well, you brought up JCPenney, trying to go after a whole different type of consumer, and that brings a listener comment to the fore here, which actually came in before we started talking. Mm-hmm. This listener says, except for the name Belk, this store has been gone for a while. The type of brand fandom that prolonged the death of big boxes is an outmoded phenomenon in itself. Mm-hmm. Anybody who cared saw this coming. Maybe the soul of Belk is riding around in an Amazon Prime van. We're going to talk a lot about what sets Belk apart from Dillard's or Macy's or some of the other mid-market retail giants. But is there, in your mind, Catherine, is there really a need for department stores anymore?
Department stores are in a very difficult place. Let me put it like that. I mean, probably more so than any other type of retailers. Still, when you look at, for instance, the likes of like Nordstrom, they're actually sort of managing to do it much better. So what you have to do is you have to stop thinking about yourself as being a brick and mortar player, but being an omnichannel type of player. I know it's one of those buzzwords that everybody likes to use, but you really have to sort of become good on both fronts, sort of good online, good in stores, bring the two together. And actually for a consumer, it shouldn't matter where you buy, whether it's online or in store, or whether you bring back something in store or have it delivered to you. So the only thing that should matter is that you are getting it from a brand, whether that is Belk, whether that is Nordstrom. The absolute fact, whether it's brick and mortar or online, should be completely immaterial to a consumer. And that is what you, as a retailer, also have to take into account. And that means that you have to completely transform the way you do business. And at the same time, and now I really want to go back to what you were saying, you have to sort of keep the soul of the brand in there. And you also have to think about retailers as brands. So why, what was Belk to people? Right. And lots of people are losing that also, or businesses are losing that as they are transforming.
And we'll talk about what Belk meant after over these 133 years of its existence as we go through this. Daphne, Sycamore and Belk's other creditors have committed $225 million in new capital to help this store weather the storm. In this retail environment, the decline of bricks and mortar, the rise of online retail, the pandemic, keeping everybody home and cutting down on in-store traffic, why would you pour more money into this venture? It seems like good money after bad.
Well, I mean, you know, when the Belk family sold the chain to Sycamore, there was in certain quarters of the retail industry, it just seemed like a stroke of genius to a family who's been in the business for 130 years sees the end of the road and gets out with
at the right time,
just in time. The question for Sycamore is, for a private equity firm, it's so much about the financial transaction, the financial investment, and saving the financial investment. It's an open question how much they're truly going to invest in the business of retailing that goes back to what Katrine was talking about. Just what does it take to reinvent the department store? Belk actually did a lot of things right. There are a lot of locations that aren't necessarily in enclosed malls, which right now is a terrible place to be. But you know, they sell a ton of apparel. Apparel sales are going down. Everyone's wearing yoga pants all the time. There are a lot of different forces working against department stores, and I'm not sure that Sycamore's financial investment is going to be fully invested in solving those problems.
So they are, we're going to talk a lot about that too. So they're getting $225 million in new capital. They're going to be shedding $450 million in debt. And they hope to be out of bankruptcy by the end of today. I mean, this is a quick hearing in Texas, and we'll talk about why it's in Texas. When we come back, I want to talk just for a second about their pledge at Belk not to close any stores or lay off any employees as a result of this bankruptcy, whether that's realistic and whether the truth is actually hidden in some of the conversations Sycamore has been having with its creditors leading up to this bankruptcy. Well, that'll have to wait till we come back after the break. We'll talk some more about this through the hour at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Belk. They're in bankruptcy. They filed bankruptcy last night in Texas. The hearing is going on as we speak, this bankruptcy hearing, and we're joined by Daphne Howland, a senior reporter for Retail Dive, which speaks directly to trends in the retail industry. Katrin Helens is with us. She's a professor of marketing at the UNC Kenan Flagler Business School. As I said just before the break, Belk is promising, Sycamore Partners is promising, there will be no layoffs at Belk, no store closings of any Belk stores, and there are lots of them around the Southeast. But at the same time, it is out that leading up to this bankruptcy hearing today, they took a hint to their lenders that cuts could come after the store is out of bankruptcy. If they plan to be out of bankruptcy by the end of business today, will there be an announcement tomorrow about layoffs or store closings? Are they being coy about this, Daphne?
They could be. I mean, it depends a lot how many of those locations are owned and run by Belk itself. They have a lot more leeway for any of those stores, and how many have leases in that are basically contracts with outside landlords. Certainly, if the long game resets, once again, Sycamore wants to find a buyer for this retailer at some point in the future. Running a healthy number of stores sort of cuts both ways. Is your chain at a healthy point? Are you running too many locations? It's a question for any retailer, and certainly I think we've noticed that most retailers are running too many stores.
This is a real quick fall from grace, because in 2019 you wrote a column, about what their plans were in 2019 for Belk. They were going to take the store nationwide, make it a nationwide name like Macy's or even Nordstrom. That stopped with the pandemic. You also write that Macy's also had to hit the brakes shortly after announcing a turnaround in 2020. And all of this is due to the pandemic and the woes the pandemic has placed on retailers at all levels. Talk about the scuttled Macy's turnaround and the plans for Belk. Would they have worked minus the pandemic?
I'm not sure. Macy's just had a meeting yesterday where they updated everyone on their turnaround strategy, and they more or less said it's on track. But, you know, even a year ago when they first announced it, it entailed closing 125 stores nationwide. So even Macy's, who became a nationalized retailer in, 2005, 2006, is now shrinking those ambitions. And I don't see any department store going in the other direction.
Katrin, department stores are a creation, I guess, of the late 1800s. I'm wondering if they have a place today. Reinvention seems to be the order of the day here, but How do you reinvent a brick and mortar department store chain with stores at all levels and all these different shopping malls when I can go to my computer and buy it on Amazon?
Well, first and foremost, there's one thing I would like to sort of like emphasize is that store floor, physical store floor does play a very important role in actually retail today and in the future. That is also the reason why you actually see Amazon investing in brick and mortar. They need it. And just before we go into what does it mean to consumers, why are retailers attached to brick and mortar? It is because quite simply the entire online model itself may not be sustainable just from a cost perspective. Without sort of like going into a ton of detail, just getting individual goods delivered to everyone's doorstep is just extremely expensive. It's called the cost of fulfillment, the last mile issue. And just for that very reason, you have to think about stores almost as a mini distribution center where you can actually sort of motivate people to go and pick up whatever they ordered online. So it's fine if people order things online, but actually having it delivered to their doorstep, that is where actually sometimes the entire thing starts falling apart. That is why you see that Amazon wants stores, that actually there were sort of rumors that they wanted to buy the entire JCPenney chain. Or just for that reason, you actually do need stores as an anchor point. still that requires that consumers want to go to those stores. Yeah. So because obviously that's the only way it's going to work. So what you then have to think is like, why do people want to go to stores? You have to think about the pure sales, the pure transactional argument. You have to go way beyond that. Think about the entire journey, the customer journey, as they typically call it, and see like what then are the aspects that we will, can, and will never be able to fulfill online. And then, of course, you sort of start to venture into everything that touches upon experience, social aspects. And I know that that sounds weird in COVID times, but that will probably be the only way to sort of give added value to brick and mortar. Really think about a store as a place where you can interact, where you can learn, where you can sort of like be entertained without sort of necessarily saying that you that it just has to be fun stuff, but really as a completely different way of bringing people together. That means that you have to take inventory out of the store. That's fine. If you actually have a good online business set up together with your brick and mortar, that's fine. You can even sort of like ask people to order things online while they're in the store. But once again, it asks for a completely different way of organizing or setting up your stores.
What I'm hearing you say is that in many ways, these brick and mortar stores become a showroom. You can go in and kick the tires, feel the fabric, try on a pair of shoes, yep. But then you order it and it's delivered to your door. Can you survive? The rent on these stores must be astronomical. Can you survive if you're just going to have a place to kick the tires?
And that is where we have to talk about the big box. Is the big box still sort of like the model that we want to work with? So what you have is, yes, store floor is important, but what type of store floor? So you actually sort of actually can reduce the actual store floor a lot if you want to. Actually, in some sort of like projections, you see that it will shrink to like 1/4 and even less. Most of that will just be taken up by logistics, sort of like, you know, this is the place where you prepare your online orders and everything like that. And talking about showrooms, Nordstrom has been actually testing pure showroom models where the only thing that they have is you go there, they sort of like show you literally all kinds of clothing. It's a personal shopping type of environment. And no, you cannot take anything home with you. So really, when you're talking about showroom, yes, that is to a certain extent what we're going towards. We are sort of like giving you an experience. Obviously, you're also going to infuse it with lots of services and everything that helps you in making certain transactions and making certain purchases. But yes, this actual purpose of a store will less and less be transactional, but really sort of going towards services, experience, all things social.
What I'm hearing you say and what I'm hearing Daphne talk about when it comes to the economics of this sounds very much like what happened to the broadcasting business and to the newspaper business over time, where the business model had to change because of the influx of digital technology. So printed newspapers and local broadcasting became very expensive, and so they began to lay off people. That impacted the product, and so to keep it afloat and keep it alive, they found buyers to come in, and these buyers bought up multiple outlets, multiple newspapers, multiple broadcast stations, and suddenly incurred all of this debt that they had to pay, and they couldn't. So then they continued to cannibalize the product to the point where we have daily newspapers now that look like a high school newspaper, as opposed to what they used to be. What I'm hearing Katrin say, Daphne, is that we're going to witness the hollowing out of these big box stores to practically nothing. Newspapers matter to me. The fact that we don't have a great big newspaper in most towns anymore bothers me because information is what we need in a democracy. Should I be bothered by the decline of retail?
We don't know exactly how Sycamore runs its retailers. It owns several. And we don't know how Belk's been run because it's all now a private company. In general, private equity firms do tend to make investments. It's a financial consideration. They make fees from these retailers in addition to the other kind of financial maneuverings that we're seeing in the Chapter 11 court today. The investments don't tend to go to the business of retailing. And, you know, it's worth remembering that back in the day, department stores were excellent at getting people to go to their brick and mortar stores because they, it wasn't, and it was a lot about customer service and literally knowing the customer that walked through the door, but also their merchandising. You know, when the Belk buyers went to the New York shows to find the apparel that they were going to be selling to their customers in their region, they knew the taste and the culture that was specific to their customer base. That kind of deep talent that is necessary to run what a department store was and what it was good at is not, I don't think, is showing up at Belk or a lot of other places.
I think anybody who remembers Ivy's here in Charlotte could easily tell the difference between what Ivy's was trying to do to their customer base and what Belk was trying to do. And when Ivy's disappeared, it left a big hole in the market. And you mentioned customer service. That's how Nordstrom has made their name. They'll do anything, just about, for their customers. But as a marketing expert, we have in an average mall, you have three or four big anchor department stores. At South Park here in Charlotte, we have Belk, we have Macy's, we have Dillard's. We'll set Nordstrom and Neiman Marcus aside because that's a different customer. But Belk and Macy's and Dillard's, it seems to me, are going after the same identical customer. Catherine, what sets them apart? You're the marketing expert here. Why would I shop in any of those stores? What would bring me to one as opposed to the other?
Well, in general, what you have is that all of these sort of what we would call middle ground type of retailers are having a really big time just because, let's put it like this, they were trying to please everyone. They didn't try to offend anyone, but they were also sort of like a bit, you know, plain vanilla. And that is where most retailers are having a really hard time. It is so much, not easier, but it's relatively easier these days if you actually can sort of like position yourself either more on the price dimension or really on the opposite end of the spectrum, going really more premium, sort of going to a completely different type of style. So it's what they call the bifurcation of retail. It's really that middle ground that is suffering because quite honestly, it's very hard to distinguish yourself, not just from one another, but also from everything that you can quite easily find online. So it's the entire, and I think it's nice that we just touched upon that, the sort of like Belk in the past, really sort of going to the New York shows, that aspect of curation, they completely lost. And that is also where most of these of retailers have to focus on in the future, is that, hey, if you can find endless aisles online, that is also sometimes hard for consumers because you try to find what you like in all that in that endless aisle, which can also be an endless mess. If you know that there's a retailer out there that understands you and actually does the job for you, they go and select the goods, that can actually give you an added value.
But
that,
you know,
that is you, what they lost, and in, as a consequence, it's sort of like, yeah, why go there?
Department stores started as a one-stop shopping locale where you could go and you can buy everything: women's wear, men's wear, men's shoes, women's shoes, toys for the kids, cosmetics for women. You could buy housewares, dishes, and silverware, and bedding, and all. You could go to one place and do it all. And go
electronics home. Too. Yeah.
Right. Electronics, furniture, in many cases, could be bought at these department stores. Well, now all these department stores make their lives living in malls. And the malls have multiple shoe stores and electronic stores and cosmetic stores. Why do you need them? I mean, if you're looking for a curated collection of material that specifies your taste, that speaks to your taste, why do you need any department store? Why don't you just go to the mall and pick the store out that you like?
No, it is a valid point. And once again, also as a department store, you may want to sort of completely rethink the way you're working. Even like, once again, I was talking about big boxes. Why don't you just shrink the box and follow your consumer wherever they go? That is what you're seeing everywhere. Even the Lowe's and the Home Depots of the world are shrinking their boxes and moving into city centers. You actually, if convenience is what people need these days and what they can get online, you actually have to make, you know, lives of your consumers even more easy and almost like really literally pick up your store and follow them wherever they are. That can be partially online, but also by rethinking your real estate and thinking like, what is the right type of box that I need to really please my consumers? Is that in a mall? Is that in a typical classic sort of like location that we've sort of known for decades? I don't think so. So also from that point of view, going back to the earlier discussion, can they sort of like, can Belk sort of like thrive with their existing real estate? It's obviously hard to say so, but I actually sort of question it just from that point of view.
Daphne, she just talked about losing talent, the buyers that used to go out to the New York shows and buy the clothing for the next season. They knew their customer base, and that's why people flocked to Belk as opposed to Macy's, or Macy's as opposed to Dillard's, because they knew that those stores knew what they wanted. In the absence of that talent and all of the things, all of the challenges that retailers are facing, particularly department stores, do companies like Sycamore Partners, that are now these conglomerates that own all these retailers, have that talent or even an understanding that they need that talent to survive this storm?
I don't know. However, I think it's telling that two of the best performing department store chains, still challenged and especially challenged after this COVID year, are Dillard's and Nordstrom, where family members continue to be very much involved. Mm-hmm. I think there's just a level of care there about the business. I think there's another thing, as the departments that you talked about emptied out and sort of headed to the specialty retailers down the corridor in the mall, department stores just filled up those empty spaces with more apparel, just as Americans started to dress down for work, dress down for weddings, dress down for church, didn't really need the kinds of the variety of apparel that department stores had ever more of. But there's another thing I think for these middle retailers that are catering to the middle class is that the middle class just doesn't have as much money.
When we come back, I want to talk about that, because that's one of Belk's problems. Katherine, you pointed out that they have always banked on the growing middle class of North Carolina and throughout the South, and those people are disappearing. We'll come back and talk about that and more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Belk bankruptcy. They're in bankruptcy court as we speak in Texas right now. And they're in Texas because the bankruptcy court in Texas has a tendency to turn things around very, very quickly, which gives creditors very little time to make objections to things and keeps them in business. And in fact, Belk has said, or Sycamore Partners that owns Belk, has said that they want to be out of bankruptcy by the end of today. And they may be. We're here with Daphne Howland, who's a senior reporter for Retail Dive, which writes about the retail industry, and Katherine Helens, a professor of marketing at UNC Kenan Flagler School of Business. You point out, Katherine, that the growing middle class of the South buying mid-priced clothing helped Belk grow, but that the modern-day environment does not reward middle ground anymore, and that the middle class is disappearing, and that this pandemic has really exacerbated that and quickened that. What we have is the have and have nots, leaving not many people in the middle, and the haves will go to Nordstrom and pay the prices that Nordstrom charges. The others go to TJ Maxx, to Costco, to Sam's Club. Where does that leave Dillard's, Macy's, Belk?
Well, once again, that is the question, because the middle ground is really disappearing. And unless you sort of reposition yourself, you will have a hard time. And I think it's even more complicated than the middle class disappearing. It's also the middle class behaving differently, in the sense that it's not that you are sort of constantly going for your typical mid-range type of products. Either people will sort of indulge and sort of like on one shopping trip, sort of like go more premium. Whereas on other times they will think, you know what, actually I don't sort of, what's the point in paying so much for it? Let's really go down and sort of like go more to discount range, or sort of like go to TJ Maxx. It's also that middle income type of consumer who's behaving and shopping in a completely different way. So once again, it's sort of like being stuck in the middle is where it really becomes hard. And if it's just about you and the merchandise, and you don't have anything to offer beyond that, that you will actually struggle. So once again, it is then what can you offer that sort of like makes people come to you?
Yeah.
And that probably will have to be in everything that touches upon personalization and services and you name it. So once again, by just sort of like trying to do it with the merchandise, it's not going to work. And it's most definitely not going to work with your current locations.
Louise on Facebook writes, I think the younger generation is not interested in physically going to a store. They would rather order online and have the merchandise delivered at home. That is a stumbling block. John on Facebook writes, I like to feel clothing. I do too. I'd like to feel clothing and try it on before I buy clothes. For instance, I would never buy a pair of shoes without trying them on and walking in them. And I'm not going to order them online only to send them back. That's just too much trouble. But he says, I'd like to try things on before I buy clothes. You can't do that online. That's why I go to a store like Belk's. Plus, they can alter suits, pants, shirts to provide a better fit. You can't get that online either. Can department stores, can Belk continue to offer those services even if they charge for them in this environment going forward, Catherine?
Well, if they don't, then they really don't have a future. Because as I was saying, is if you don't do that, and you probably have to go way beyond that, and really be very creative in trying to think like, what is convenience for consumers these days? And how can I sort of go beyond the, hey, whatever I can get online? So if there's one thing that they cannot sort of like drop or lose, then it's actually those type of services. It's the personalization type of aspect. It's everything that makes your life as a consumer easier. And I actually just want to touch upon one comment that was made online. It's like younger people actually prefer to buy things online. What we do see, and especially now, what we've learned during the pandemic, is that lots of people are craving to go back to the store. There is a complete sensory depletion. We actually are born with five senses, and we need them to sort of, we need them activated.
I was going to ask about that because we are being told by economists that when this is over, when the pandemic is over, we can anticipate a boom because of the pent up demand, and that will certainly benefit restaurants. Will it benefit retail? Will we see a return to bricks and mortar stores because we just want to go out and touch stuff?
Well, you do already, obviously, turning to the East, and I'm now talking too about Asia, where obviously the pandemic is in a different stage, you do see a surge also for more luxury type of goods, for any type, anything that's not just that people weren't sort of spending their money on during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Because we are talking about what you have, and that is perhaps a different situation as what we had before, is that, yes, you have people who are having a very hard time because they lost their job, but you also have people who just kept working as normal, but were spending less. And we're also a bit hesitant because, hey, you don't know how things are going to evolve. But as a consequence of that, they actually have a lot more discretionary income to spend in perhaps months and years to go. So, yes, it is most likely going to happen. And this is what you already see in certain Asian markets.
Daphne, you write that one of the things that Belk has in its favor is that it has a lot of stores in smaller, unenclosed strip malls. And the trend is back to unenclose. I remember when they used to take these unenclosed strip malls and put a roof on them because people wanted to be under one roof. Well, now it's a good thing to be in a strip mall that doesn't have a roof on it. And a lot of these stores are much smaller than what we would think of as a normal Belk store. But is that enough? To be in these smaller malls, is that enough to compensate for the other factors, including falling clothing sales during a pandemic and the rise of discount retailers and the decline of the middle class that we talked about? This sounds like a perfect recipe for disaster, no matter where you're located.
I think it's the exact right question. Is it enough? A very few years ago, it seemed like a magical place to be. Belk seemed to be proving it. Kohl's seemed to be proving it. It's not turning out to be enough, I don't think. And I think it's all these different forces, the apparel growth that is ebbing. People, by the way, I think over the past year have learned that they can do it with less apparel than they thought they did. I think people clean out their closets. I think younger generations are interested in secondhand clothing. You know, there's a lot of forces working against a retailer like Belk that location doesn't really solve.
Forbes points out that Belk's flagship store at South Park is a far cry from what it was even in the 1970s. Because Belk decided that that store was in a high-dollar neighborhood, and the mall was going to become a high-dollar mall, and now they sell things like Versace and Burberry and Prada in a department store as opposed to a boutique. But that is not what they're selling at the Belk at Stuttgart, Arkansas, where they're catering to a very, very different customer. So, Catherine, in this online world, when you're reinventing yourself, what does it mean to be Belk? What are you selling? It's different everywhere.
Well, actually, that is what you have to do. You really have to, and this is what you call micro-marketing, you almost have to try and adjust to each and every local market that you're in. So it's really not just going in with a very standardized type of selection. You really have to understand your local consumer, and you have to really take it even much further than what they've been doing so far. And it's once again talking about that curation aspect. One thing I would like to sort of bring into the mix is that, yes, it requires talent, but it also requires a lot of investment into data analysis and good, well, computing skills, because it will help you a great deal in understanding your consumers, reacting to how consumers behave, and sort of being able to sort of move in a very flexible way. And just to give you somewhat of an idea is that if you think about a really fast fashion type of retailer who has actually excelled at that, is actually Zara. They actually sort of really micro market each and every store by just observing what their consumers doing, and actually within 14 days can actually completely change the entire assortment that they have in their stores. And that is also something that a lot of these department stores probably will have to try and mimic much more, because they have just been moving too slowly. Because once again, that is not just a threat that you have from the online world, but it's also just something that they have to learn and mimic from certain fast fashion retailers.
Along with Belk, Daphne, Sycamore Partners, which is their new owner in the last 6 years, Sycamore Partners owns Staples, Talbots, and The Limited. Toward the end of the year, they acquired Ann Taylor, Loft, and Lane Bryant. They have allowed other big names like Nine West to go defunct. But of all the names that they own, it seems to me that Belk is the biggest. Is it the biggest and most important brand, and the one that they would likely try harder to keep afloat? Or is this just a situation where these big money companies come in, buy things, churn it around, or as David emails, financiers, private equity firms like Sycamore leverage their acquisitions out of existence and gut these companies, cutting employees' expenses to the bare bone, then claim the business was not viable. They just churn and move on to the next investment.
I think that for Sycamore and the situation Belk is in right now, I think it's overwhelmingly a financial consideration. And private equity, actually Retail Dive did a series on this that is probably worth checking out, just how private equity in general, not speaking about Sycamore per se, operates. But, you know, I think that all retailers, or a lot of retailers, have lost the sense of sort of having three stakeholders, shareholders, customers, and employees in as they consider how to run their business. And while I think there's a lot of trying to cater to the consumer, it's not necessarily treating the customer as a stakeholder. I mean, I think one thing, retailers are so focused on convenience right now, and it's definitely necessary. And I think COVID showed them that they can do it, curbside and in-store fulfillment and stuff. But I think the need for convenience for so many American consumers is just that stressed out, busy life that isn't necessarily, you know, the convenience play isn't necessarily helping you present yourself as a great place to shop so much as taking a little bit of the pain away of people's day-to-day existence. That's not a really compelling reason to shop at a given retailer.
Well, you know, when Belk started, I think maybe it was the downtown store. I wasn't here then, but I'm told that they had, as many department stores had, they had a tea room or a restaurant. I know that when the Belk South Park store opened, they had a restaurant and they had a wine shop. They still do, I think, Arthur's. If you want to make shopping an experience, a destination, a reason for you to choose one store over another, why eliminate all these different things that made you unique? Was that, in hindsight, was that a mistake? Should they bring that back? Would that help, Catherine?
Well, it's funny that you sort of mentioned it, because that is actually what people are saying, that what you have to invest in right here, right now, if you want your business and your retail business to succeed in the future, it's bringing in the social aspect. Restaurants, cafes, you name it, even co-working spaces, anything that just brings in people just for a reason that is not necessarily just to shop, but making sure that they actually sort of enter the store. And once you they enter the store, you can still sort of like, you know, stimulate them, convince them to buy something, but really bring them in for things that, you know, touch upon experience, social aspects. That's it. Even you even have toy stores opening up store floor for playgrounds, the DIY demonstrations in certain other stores. It doesn't really matter, but really the crux is as just take products from away from the store floor and open it up for any type of experiential type of element.
We have about 2 minutes left, so very quickly, I'd like to hear from each of you on this. If Belk wants to survive and succeed, what message, Catherine, must they send to their customers? How do they speak to customers to get them to come back?
Well, one thing that they understand them, and I think that's what they completely lost, that what they actually sort of offer in their store is actually there specially for them, and it's something that you cannot necessarily find anywhere else, that they're there to help you, that they are there to help you sort of find the things that you need, that you can, that they can, that your that the consumer can trust them. That is really what they completely lost. And once again, it's very much about curation. If you as a department store, that's what you need to do to nail.
Well, Belk's CEO said their focus would shift to home goods, outdoor apparel, activewear. I'm not sure that's enough to keep them afloat, but if they want to survive and succeed, Daphne, what changes do they have to make in their mixture of merchandise, their approach to reaching customers, their locations, etc.? And I have 30 seconds.
I mean, those are the categories that are doing well now, driven in large part by COVID. Those trends are going to come and go. That's how retail has always worked. If I were them, I would make sure they have happy employees in those stores. I think it will go far to send the signal that it's a happy, healthy retailer.
And yes or no question, with a yes or no answer, I'll start with you, Daphne. In 5 years, in 10 years, is Belk a name we're going to be reminiscing about or still talking about as an active store? Daphne.
Tough one. I'm going to probably lean toward reminiscing, but okay. Retail is a tricky business. We never know.
Catherine, your answer very quickly?
I agree with Daphne. I also fear it's going to be reminiscing.
Wow. Okay, well, Catherine Helens is with us, the professor of marketing at UNC Kenyon Flagler School of Business, and Daphne Howland, senior reporter for Retail Dive. Thank you both for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.